Hi, welcome. This is On Science. I'm not Chris Joyce. I'm Joe Palca.
I'm Chris Joyce.
And today, we have a really interesting podcast for you. First, largely because both Chris and I have pieces in it, so it can't be bad after that.
Yours is first, though.
Yeah, that's right. So if they're still listening, they'll get to yours. We also have a story about phthalates in children's toys, which is actually a pretty interesting question, because how do you decide when something is safe or not? And the answer seems to be whoever shouts the loudest gets his way.
Or whoever can pronounce phthalates correctly.
Well, that's probably
me. Don't forget your story, Joe, about how heart cells can regenerate.
Oh, that is my story. And we also have one from E.O. Wilson about when you're dead. And the good news is that neither E.O. Wilson, yeah, it's how do you smell when you're dead, and we'll get to that. But first, my story about
heart muscle cells. What? You've missed one.
No, I haven't. Yours. Chris has a story.
Hammer-headed bats. Or hammerhead bats. That was a big deal when we did this story, because the scientists who studied them called them hammer-headed, but Webster's called them hammerhead, and we really had to work on this to decide what we were going to call them.
Yeah, the pedants come out of the woodwork on these kinds of things.
Okay. Take it away, Joe.
Well, this is a story about heart cells, and the interesting thing, there's this notion from medical science that you're born with all the heart muscle cells you're going to get. And that's because when you have a heart attack, all you see is scar tissue after the heart attack. You don't see new muscle cells. But these guys in Sweden did a really interesting thing. And what they did was they used a date stamp on cells to see when they were born, to see if all of them were as old as the person they were taking them from.
Okay, I'm with
sense?
You. I think
okay.
So.
All right.
Keep going.
So how do you date stamp a cell in a body?
Let me guess. Radioactivity.
Right. But not everybody wants to have themselves exposed to radioactivity. So what do? Well, you take the case where they didn't have a choice about being exposed, the atomic bomb tests during the Cold War.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I did cheat, and I listened to this story. Well, mm-hmm. I did hear it. And it's carbon-14?
Yeah.
But there's carbon-14 all over the place. It's not just from those weapons tests.
Right. But there was a spike of it. There was more of it that went into the atmosphere.
Is it the same kind, or is it a different isotope?
It's the same kind.
Oh, okay.
But there's just more, and if you compare it, well, that's what they did. They compared, but maybe we can listen to the piece. Okay, here's how it works. Rutan Bardwaj is a physician and scientist who went to work at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
We had this common idea of asking a very crazy question of, could we possibly date old cells?
That is, tell when the cell first came to be. Now, there are some cells in your body that you've had since you were a baby, but others are constantly turning over. Your outer layer of skin cells have only been around for a matter of days or weeks. But cells don't have dates stamped on them when they're born, so Bardwaj and his colleagues had to come up with another way of dating them. And then they thought of the above-ground atomic bomb tests in the Cold War.
The atomic bombs liberated a demonstrable amount of C-14, which we could actually trace and figure out how old that cell is based on that.
C-14 is a radioactive form of carbon. This stuff spread all over the planet and got into everything, including people. Not enough to make them sick, but enough to detect in their cells. So the atomic bomb test provided the date stamp Bardwaj needed. Even after the tests ended, there was more carbon-14 around than before the tests, so there was a carbon-14 date stamp even for people born in the 1980s, just a smaller one. As they report in the journal Science, when Bardwaj and his colleagues used carbon-14 levels to see how many heart muscle cells were turning over, to their surprise, they saw there were some. Not a lot, but some.
Only about 1% turnover in a 20-year-old, but the amazing thing is that level isn't zero, and that's precisely what we didn't understand before.
The rate actually goes down to about 0.33% for people in their 70s. But Bardwaj says the point is, it's not zero.
The long-standing view has been that the heart is one of the least regenerative organs in the body.
Chuck Murray is a stem cell biologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. There are three classes of cells in the heart: the ones that make up blood vessels, the ones that make up connective tissue, and the ones that make up the heart muscle. Murray says the blood vessels and connective tissue clearly regenerate.
And the big debate really has been whether there is any turnover of the muscle cells.
Murray says the new research proves there is. And he says there are two main implications from this research.
The first is that your heart muscle cells are very long-lived, and that you're going to probably die with most of the cells that you were born with, so you better take good care of them.
You know what he means. Eat the right foods, get exercise, etc., etc.
The second thing is the more optimistic note, which is, since there is a little bit of turnover, if we can figure out how this works, we can exploit it therapeutically.
In other words, find some way to coax the heart into repairing itself after a heart attack or trauma. That would be an unexpected bit of good news inspired by the Cold War atomic tests. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Using carbon-14 like that is clever, and it's actually not just the domain of people who do biomedical research. I mean, archaeologists obviously use it, but...
Right, but the thing here is they're
not... The bomb test, too. They use the bomb test.
Right, but the difference, and this is what confused some people, this isn't the half-life of carbon-14, because that's on the order of 5,000 years.
Right.
This is the absolute amount that went into the atmosphere in one big bolus, and it's been not decaying ever since, but it's been dissipating as it gets buried away and
sequestered. What was the year of these tests?
55, 63.
Yeah. So that means I got it.
Actually, the signal is still measurable. It's higher than it was pre-1955 in some parts of the world.
Yeah.
Well,
John Hamilton's here.
Hi, guys.
Hi, John. We're going to hear a story that John did this week.
Okay, Chris, tell us what it's about.
Phthalates. I think I got that pronounced correctly, right, John?
Yep.
Rubber duckies aren't what they used to be. As of a couple of months ago, duckies and other plastics objects that have softeners in them called phthalates.
Don't
anymore.
No,
they don't, yeah. Congress banned them, and these are additives in children's products often, and the problem was they might cause health problems. But what's odd about this ban is that the government scientists who actually studied phthalates in toys found no evidence they pose a risk to children. So John took a look at the collision that we saw between science and politics.
The agency that regulates rubber ducks is the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It's a small outfit, several hundred staffers working in one of those anonymous glass buildings outside Washington, D.C. The commission usually does stuff like recalling toys a child might choke on. But for more than 25 years now, it's also been studying phthalates, which are used to make PVC plastic soft. And the commission has acted several times to protect children from these chemicals. Dr. Marilyn Wynn says it's obvious which products might cause problems.
You want to look at something that's the most exposure. And the most exposure is the things that kids keep in their mouths. And those would be rattles, squeeze toys, teethers, pacifiers.
In the 1980s, soft toys contained a phthalate called DEHP. Wynn says the commission was worried enough about it to convene a panel of experts.
And they concluded that DEHP was a rodent carcinogen. They also concluded that there were developmental and reproductive effects from DEHP.
Again, in rodents. No one knew what DEHP did to people, so the commission decided to play it safe and limit the chemical in certain kids' products. Before that could happen, though, companies voluntarily removed DEHP from items meant to be mouthed. Instead, the industry began softening toys with a different phthalate, called DINP. And Wynn says in the late 1990s, scientists found evidence that DINP caused liver problems in rodents. It didn't look like there was a risk to children, but Wynn says the commission went back to industry anyway.
We made them aware of what we had found, and they voluntarily removed DINP from toys that could be mouthed.
The commission also began some experiments to figure out just how much DINP kids were getting from toys. In one study, scientists had adults chew on soft plastic to make sure they knew how much phthalate got into saliva during a minute in the mouth. An expert panel used that information to conclude that, even in a worst-case scenario, it would take a child at least 75 minutes a day of chewing or sucking to have the slightest risk from exposure. In a second experiment, the commission sent trained observers into homes and daycare centers to find out what 169 children really did with their toys. Wynn says each observer carried a stopwatch.
Every time a child put something in their mouth, they recorded it, clicked the timer, and when the child took it out of their mouth, they clicked the timer again and recorded the time.
The study showed that even young children kept toys in their mouths less than 2 minutes a day. Wynn says by 2003, the science was pretty clear.
We could not ban DINP because there was not a risk of injury to children.
Wynn summarized the whole story for Congress. The phthalate most likely to pose a risk had been removed from kids' mouths 25 years ago. To be extra cautious, another phthalate was taken out of pacifiers, teethers, and rattles 10 years ago. And years of study since then had found no danger from using this phthalate in other kids' products. Here's how lawmakers responded.
I have here two rubber duckies.
A rubber duck sold at Walgreens had 13 times the amount of phthalates now permissible under California law.
And it can be absorbed from those products during use into a young child's body.
They're linked to both birth and other serious reproductive defects.
Liver cancer, kidney cancer.
Potential harm to testosterone development and the male reproductive tract, early onset puberty in girls, and thyroid dysfunction.
That was Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts, former Representative Darlene Hooley from Oregon, and Representative Jan Schakowsky from Illinois. Their statements parroted the fears of consumer and environmental groups that have pushed to ban all PVC plastics in children's products. And it was enough to pass the law banning phthalates. But Wind from the Consumer Product Safety Commission says she stands by the studies.
I know that we did really good science. And sometimes people don't listen to the good science.
Even when it comes from the government scientists we pay for good advice.
So, John, you're here. Listening to this piece, the thing struck me is it sounds like a slam dunk. There is absolutely no evidence that these phthalates pose a risk, and yet they've been banned in the EU or some of them in the EU and the U.S. I mean, is there no shred of science evidence that seems to support keeping these out of products?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that the Consumer Product Safety Commission actually found enough cause that they asked for the industry to voluntarily remove two of these phthalates from products. So what's interesting is that Congress' view was that the Consumer Product Safety Commission had done little or nothing, when in fact they had done quite a bit. As for Europe, it's interesting that in both the U.S. and Europe, the regulatory agencies weren't the ones that found the problem. In both cases, the ban came from elected officials.
So these are situations where the loudest voice in the room, the biggest complainer, gets the way, even if there's no science behind it? I'm putting you on the spot here, John, because it does sound like there's just no rhyme or reason to having these bans in place from a scientific standpoint.
It all comes down to something I'm going to do a piece about, which is called the precautionary principle. How precautionary do you want to be? I mean, no one can say there's no science, as if you can't say it has been proved safe.
Right.
What you can say is that the efforts so far to find out whether there is a risk have not shown a risk.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a difficult problem.
There's another irony that I see in it. You know, you talk to people in the environmental movement and in the climate science, and they say that the federal government's scientists have been quashed, and that, you know, when they come out, like James Hansen does at NASA, and talk about the dangers of climate change, they're ignored. In this case, you know, the scientists will ignore it again, but for the opposite reason, is that they don't happen to agree with the popular views, and many of those popular views are presented by environmentalists. They, you know, it's pick your poison, but you know, you get what you want to hear.
No, it's funny because it's true. You know, there was one set of political principles that colored people's attitudes towards science in the last administration, and you can be pretty sure that there's going to be another set of political agendas that are going to color people's attitudes towards the science coming out of this administration. I mean, if strip mining turns out to be good for the environment, I hope there's no federal scientists who are going to try and say so.
And it's worth noting that this ban on phthalates was signed by who? President Bush.
Mm-hmm. There you go, two humps. That's a two-humper.
And there's another point that it is not clear to me that Congress thought about, which is what is going to replace these phthalates. And they have said in the legislation that it's supposed to be something safe, but as we know, most chemicals have not been tested for safety. And what's more, the people who make these don't even have to tell you what they're replacing the phthalates with. So it sort of remains to be seen whether we made the world safer or not.
Of course we did, John. Of course we did.
Thank you, Joe. I feel better.
Thanks, John. So now we have Robert Krulwich, who has a very interesting little tale about ants, talking with E.O. Wilson about how you tell when an ant is dead.
People don't get this about ants, says ant scholar E.O. Wilson, world-famous biologist. When we people communicate with each other, we talk. We talk and talk and listen and look.
Humans are the most audiovisual creatures on Earth.
But most animals do not communicate our way, not at all.
We are highly unusual. The vast majority of creatures on Earth communicate the way the ants do, by chemicals, pheromones.
Look closely and you will find little glands on the surface of an ant.
One here produces one signal, another one up here produces another signal. They're loaded with glands that they use to communicate with.
So if an ant wants to say something to another ant, it chooses a gland to squeeze out a chemical message at a second ant, who then would go,
I think I smell it.
And that's how they talk. 50 years ago, Ed Wilson made his reputation figuring out which chemicals produce specific ant messages. For example, he was fascinated by what happens when ants die.
If an ant dies and just falls over, it may be lying with its feet sticking up.
And that dead ant will be ignored pretty much by everybody in the colony for about 2 days until the corpse is programmed to release a chemical signal which says, I'm dead. At which point, the next ant comes along and immediately grabs the body, carries it off to an ant graveyard, and apparently every ant knows the I'm dead smell.
So I decided to find out what substances it was smelling.
Ed told me on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York City recently that he knew the smell was a very repugnant, stinky odor, a very specific chemical combination.
So what I did, I got a large array of these substances.
Rancid sock smell and poop smell.
Rotting fish, that's trimethylamine. I had the essence of feces, that's Skatol and Indol. And I had all these in pure form.
So his lab was not exactly the favorite spot in the building, but he did have a little ant colony right there in his lab, plus some plastic ants. And what he'd do is he'd take a few drops of foul-smelling chemicals and then apply them.
In very tiny amounts, I was putting them on dummies.
Waiting to see what smell would make the ants treat those dummies as corpses.
Until finally, I hit the key substance. And that alone, that does it.
It was oleic acid.
When they sniff oleic acid, then that's a corpse. So I said, well, if that's the way they do it, would they treat one of their live, healthy nestmates is a corpse?
So Ed waited until a little ant just happened along on his tabletop, and he leaned over, and he squirted her with the I'm dead signal. And then the next ant that came along grabbed our ant immediately, says Ed.
Poor thing would be lifted up, kicking, you know, and taken out to the cemetery and dumped.
Didn't it clean itself off? It would start cleaning itself,
you know, like a dog trying to get itself clean. And then it would try to re-enter the colony. And if it hadn't done a good enough job,
then the next ant would pick it up and slap it back onto a pile of really, truly dead ants, and then it would have to clean itself all over again.
Finally, it would clean out all that oleic acid.
You started it. Didn't you, like, give it a shower or something?
No, I was trying to see if I could create the living dead, you know.
A zombie ant.
An ant that would come back in, you know, like this. No, I'm just kidding. I was creating a living dead.
How long did it take for this very unfortunate not-dead-dead ant to get accepted as alive again?
Well, actually, I'm just, you know, it cleans itself furiously as soon as it's got the stuff on it. It knows it's got a contaminant.
But after washing and then rewashing and re-re-washing for Ed thinks...
roughly an hour or two.
Science finally had the chemical formula for I'm dead, and the little ant, she resumed her ordinary life, presumably unaware of what had just occurred. Ants, it seems safe to say, have no chemical signal for you wouldn't believe what just happened to me. Robert Krulwich, NPR News, New York.
You know, there's no science journalist who covers biology who hasn't either made or tried to make the pilgrimage to that lab up at Harvard that E.O. Wilson runs, and it is full of ants. I can remember being up there and sitting there interviewing him and sort of scratching. Like, what is that crawling down my back? There are ants everywhere in his office. It's a great place. It's really fun.
Well, let's finish off with some creature features. What's this story about hammerhead or hammered head bats?
Hammerhead bats, or okay, hammer-headed bats, as Jack Bradbury calls them. He is a biologist at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, and he went to Gabon to study and record these amazing bats. They're big. They weigh about a pound. They have this enormous head, mostly hollow, and a larynx that's half the size of the body because it needs to make sound, and it needs to make sound to have sex. It's called a lek. It's when males get together and hang out and wait for the females to come. So let's, you know.
Yeah, what could be more appropriate at the start of baseball season than a story about bats?
Okay, let's. I can't improve on that, Joe.
There you go.
I'm sitting in the dugout canoe, And you hear in the background the river ibis, which are flying down the river, making their loud noise. And then a couple of the bats, the males, have flown across the river. They're now hanging from the trees by their feet, and they're starting to flap their wings fairly feebly. And they're starting to warm up their call, this loud, metallic honk, honk, honk. Other males come in and fly up close to a male who's calling, and he then makes that raspy, aggressive sound. And occasionally one will come up and knock the calling guy off his perch and take over his perch. They've really warmed up now. It's maybe about 6:30, quarter to 7. They're all calling at sort of a steady rate and waiting for some females to show up. Now, a female has come to the lek. She flies up and hovers in front of a particular male whose calls appeal to her. And then he speeds up and does this staccato buzz. He pulls his wings in close to his body and makes it very, very loud and very rapid buzzing sound. Gradually, she whittles her choice down to two or three, and finally she goes back to one and makes him do it several times. And then she lands next to him. There's silence. They mate. It takes 20, 30 seconds. And then she always gives this call, this release call, which says, I'm through, let me go. And then she takes off. The way in which he performs the display, how well he does it, it's like doing a dance step. How well he does it determines whether the female wants to mate with him.
And that's it for science. I mean, that's it for us. I mean, that's it. I mean, I'm sitting here on the bus. So, Chris, my question after I hear all of these is...
Yes, I took dancing lessons in high school.
Do you really believe these guys? I mean, they tell you, and this is a bat. Oh, sure.
No, it's a bunch of guys at Cornell who get together in a studio.
Lab. That's right. They're not going anywhere. They got a synthesizer, and they're making these.
Yeah, and you know how they make that particular bat sound?
No.
You take a cupped hand, you put it in your armpit.
Perfect. Okay, well, now on that note of high humor... that's it for this week's On Science. You're welcome to write to us if you have comments. The address is onscience@npr.org. We'll be back next week. Thanks very much. I'm Joe Palca.
And we're going to listen as we say goodbye to NPR's Song of the Day, which is called Keep on Knockin' by a band called Death.